Sergeant Kinane, gathering his papers.
I'll be back in touch if I have any more questions. And don't worry, young Cyril. We're doing everything we can to find your friend.
I left the room and looked up and down the hallway for Bridget and Mary Margaret, but they were nowhere to be seen, and so I waited for Charles, who seemed surprised to see me still standing there, and we walked out onto Pierce Street together.
"Well, goodbye," he said, shaking my hand. "Until next time."
"Have a good wedding," I told him.
"Very kind of you. And I hope they find your friend.
I feel for Max, really I do. If I'd had a son and the IRA had kidnapped him, I'd be desperately upset.
Goodbye for now, Cyril."
"Goodbye, Charles." And with that, I turned right and made my way across the road and over a Connell Street bridge back in the direction of Belvedere College, where, I felt certain, further punishment would await me. Ordinary Decent Sins. Having issued instructions as to where the £100,000 was to be left, the kidnappers signalled their disappointment at not receiving it by sending the little toe from Julian's left foot to the house on Dartmouth Square the following Tuesday. In an unnecessarily cruel gesture, they addressed the package to his younger sister, Alice, who, upon opening the blood-soaked wrapping paper, probably ran screaming from the house with the same degree of hysteria as she had during that unexplained incident 7 years earlier. "We want our money, or next time it'll be something worse. Best regards." In response, Max issued a statement to the effect that he couldn't raise the amount required in such a short space of time, an assertion that was flatly contradicted by the Dublin Evening Mail, who claimed that he had liquid assets worth more than £500,000 that could be withdrawn from the bank with only 24 hours' notice. Elizabeth Woodbead, Julian's mother and my adoptive father's erstwhile lover, appeared on the television news with tears rolling down her face, begging for her son's release. She wore a chunky locket around her neck, and some of the boys in my class speculated that it contained Julian's detached toe, a possibility that seemed too disgusting to contemplate. 3 days later, a second parcel arrived, left overnight outside the Woodbead's front door, and this time they waited for the police to arrive before opening it. Inside was the thumb from Julian's right hand. Still, Max refused to pay, and at Belvedere College a group of us gathered in my room, the official place of pilgrimage for those with an interest in the case, to debate why he was being so callous.
"He's obviously a skinflint," said James Hogan, an uncommonly tall boy who was known to have a serious crush on the actress Joanne Woodward, with whom he had been conducting a one-way relationship by post for more than a year. "Imagine not caring that your own son has been mutilated."
"It's hardly mutilation," said Jasper Timpson, a keen piano accordion player, who had the room next to ours and who was constantly annoying me by finding reasons to talk to Julian on his own. On one occasion, I had come into our room to discover the two of them sitting side by side on Julian's bed with a bottle of vodka between them, laughing so uproariously that my jealousy had nearly exploded into a fight.
"And I think Julian can survive with 9 toes and 9 fingers.
"Whether he can survive or not is hardly the point, Jasper," I said, ready to attack him if he continued to speak in so thoughtless a fashion. "It must have been terrifying for him, not to mention painful."
"Julian's a tough cookie.
You barely know him."
"I know him quite well, as it happens."
"No, you don't. You're not his roommate."
"I know he's the kind of guy who, if he was giving someone the kiss of life, he'd use tongue."
"Take that back, Timpson."
"Oh, shut up, Cyril. You're not his bloody wife, so stop carrying on as if you are."
"Have you noticed that the body parts are getting bigger?" asked James.
"I wonder is his thing bigger than his thumb?"
"It's much bigger," I said, without thinking. And they all stared at me, uncertain how to react to this intimate announcement. "Well, we share a room," I said, blushing a little. "And anyway, things are always bigger than thumbs."
"Peter's isn't," said Jasper, referring to his own roommate, Peter Trefontaine, the curious curvature of whose thing Julian had remarked upon on that fateful afternoon in the palace bar. "It's tiny, and yet he's always flashing it around our room as if he's got something to be proud of."
The third delivery came exactly a week after the kidnapping, and In their cruelest gesture yet, the box contained Julian's right ear.
"He looks just like his daddy now,"
said a note written on the back of a John Hind postcard.
The one with the two red-headed children standing on either side of a donkey laden down with turf in the boglands of Connemara. "But this is our last warning. If we don't get our money next time, it'll be his head. So pay heed to us now, and have a pleasant weekend."
A second press conference was held, this time at the Shelburne Hotel, and any sympathy that the gathered media had previously felt for Max had clearly vanished now that Julian had been deprived of three body parts. The general feeling, reflected in the country at large, was that here was a man who valued money over his own child, and so angry was the nation that an account had been set up in the Bank of Ireland where people could donate their own money to help fund the ransom. Apparently it already stood at almost half the requested amount. I only hoped that Charles hadn't been put in charge of it.
"I have heard many criticisms of late regarding my actions in this affair," declared Max, sitting upright at the press conference and wearing a Union Jack tie for added provocation. "But it will be a cold day in hell when I give a penny of my hard-earned money to a group of vicious Republicans who believe their cause can be furthered by the kidnapping and torture of a teenage boy. If I was to give them what they want, it would only be used to buy guns and bombs, which in turn would be employed against the British forces that quite rightly occupy the land north of the border and should be reinstated in the south. You can chop my son up into little bits," he added, somewhat unwisely, "and post them back to me in 100 jiffy bags, and I still won't give in to your demands."
There was a long pause as he shuffled a few papers on the desk before him. He had obviously veered away from the prepared script before piping up again.
"Obviously, I don't want you to actually do that," he said. "I was speaking metaphorically."
While all this was going on, the greatest manhunt in the history of the state was being led by Sergeant Cunane, and Julian had, within the space of a week, become perhaps the most famous person in Ireland. Gardaí in every county were following leads, checking farmhouses and deserted barns for anything that might give them a clue as to the whereabouts of the kidnappers, but without success. School continued as normal, and the priests insisted that we pray for our missing classmate before each lesson, which meant 8 prayers a day, not including our regular morning and evening benedictions, but it seemed as if God was either not listening or was on the side of the IRA. Bridget gave an interview to the evening press, in which she said that she and Julian were on the most intimate terms, and that she had never had a boyfriend who was so polite or so respectful as him. "Not once did he ever try to take advantage of me," she said between sobs, and I expected her nose to start growing, so outrageous were her lies. "I don't think such impure thoughts ever crossed his mind." On the nights when I was left alone in our room, one hand behind my head, the other down the front of my pajamas bottoms, as I lay in Julian's bed, staring up at the ceiling, I began to come to terms with who I was. I had known from as far back as I could recall that I was different to other boys. There was something inside me that longed for the intimate friendship and approval of my peers in ways that others never did. It was a disease that the priests referred to from time to time as one of the most mortal of all sins, and they told us that any boy wicked enough to have lustful thoughts about another boy would surely go straight to hell and spend eternity there, burning in the raging fires as the devil sat alongside him, laughing and poking him with his trident. There were so many times that I had fallen asleep in that room, my mind filled with lurid fantasies about Julian, whose head lay on a pillow not 10 feet from my own, his mouth half open as he dreamed, but now my fantasies were not sexual, but gruesome. I thought of what his kidnappers might be doing to him at that moment, which body part they would sever next, and how awful it must have been for him every time they took a saw or a pair of pliers to his body. I had always known Julian as a brave soul, a happy-go-lucky fellow who never let the world weigh him down, But what 15-year-old boy could possibly go through such an ordeal and come out the same person? After much soul-searching, I decided to go to confession. I thought that perhaps, if I prayed for his release and confessed my sins, then God might see fit to take pity on my friend. I didn't go to the church at Belvedere, where the priests would have recognized me and probably broken the seal at the confessional to have me expelled. Instead, I waited until the weekend and made my way into town alone, heading towards Pierce Street and the large church that stood next to the train station. I had never been there before and was a little overawed by the grandeur of the place. The altar was laid for the following day's masses, and candles were lit in rows of a dozen or more on brass stands. It cost a penny to light one, and I threw 2 halfpennies into the box before selecting one and placing it in the front row centre, watching as the flame flickered for a few moments before settling. Kneeling on the hard floor, I said a prayer, a thing I had never done with any solemnity before. "Please don't let Julian die," I asked God, "and please stop me from being a homosexual." Only when I stood up and walked away did I realize that that had been 2 prayers. So I went back and lit a 2nd candle, which cost me another penny. There were a couple of dozen people scattered around the pews and staring into space, all of them old, and I walked past them looking for a confession box with a light on. When I found one, I stepped inside, closing the door behind me, and waited in the darkness for the grill to slide open. "Bless me, Father, for I have sinned," I said quietly when it did, a gust of body odour rushing towards me with such force that I reared back and hit my head against the wall. "It has been 3 weeks since my last confession."
"What age are you, son?"
asked the voice from the other side, which sounded quite elderly. 14, I said. "I'll be 15 next month."
14-year-old boys need to go to confession more than once every 3 weeks, he said. "I know what you lads are like, up to no good every minute of the day. Will you promise me that you'll go more often in the future?"
"I will, Father."
"Good lad. Now, what sins do you have to confess to the Lord?"
I swallowed hard. I had been going to confession fairly regularly since my first communion 7 years earlier, but not once had I ever told the truth. Like everyone else, I simply made up a collection of ordinary, decent sins and rattled them off with little thought before accepting the obligatory penance of 10 Hail Marys and an Our Father afterwards. Today, however, I had promised myself that I would be honest. I would confess everything, and if God was on my side, if God really existed and forgave people who were truly contrite, then he would recognize my guilt and set Julian free without any further harm. Father, over the last month, I have stolen sweets from a local shop on 6 occasions.
"Holy God,"
said the priest, appalled.
"Why did you do that?"
"Because I like sweets," I said, "and I can't afford them."
"Oh, there's some logic to that, I suppose. And tell me, how did you do it?"
"There's an old woman who works behind the counter," I said, "and all she does is sit and read the newspaper. It's easy to take things without her noticing."
"That's a terrible sin," said the priest. "You know that's probably that good woman's livelihood."
"I do, Father."
"Will you promise me never to do such a thing again?"
"I will, Father."
"All right, then. Good lad. Anything else?"
"Yes, Father," I said. "There's a priest in our school who I don't like very much, and in my head I call him the prick."
"The what?"
"The prick."
"And what in God's name does that mean?"
"Do you not know, Father?" I asked.
"If I knew, would I be asking you?"
I swallowed hard. "It's another word for a, you know, for a thing."
"A thing? What do you mean, a thing? What class of a thing?"
"A thing, Father," I said.
"I don't know what you're talking about."
I leaned in and whispered through the grill.
"A penis, Father." "Holy God!"
he repeated.
Did I hear you right?
If you thought I said a penis, then yes, you did, Father.
Well, that is what I thought you said. Why in God's name would you call a priest in your squad a penis? How could he possibly be a penis? A man can't be a penis. He can only be a man. This makes no sense to me at all.
I'm sorry, Father. That's why I'm confessing it.
Well, whatever it is, just stop doing it. Call him by his proper name and show a bit of respect to the man. I'm sure he treats all the lads in your school well.
He doesn't, Father. He's vicious and he's always beating us up. Last year he put a boy in the hospital for sneezing too loud in class.
I don't care. You'll call him by his proper name or there'll be no forgiveness for you. Do you understand me?
Yes, Father.
Right then. I'm almost afraid to ask, but is there anything else?
There is, Father. Go on, so I'll hold on to my chair. It's a bit delicate, Father, I said.
That's what the confessional is for, son, he said. Don't worry, you're not talking to me, you're talking to God. He sees everything and he hears everything. You can have no secrets from him.
Do I have to say it then, Father? I asked. Will he not know anyway?
He will. But he wants you to say it out loud, just for clarification purposes.
I took a deep breath. This had been a long time coming, but here it was.
I think I'm a bit funny, Father, I told him. The other boys in my class are always talking about girls, but I never think about girls at all. I just think about boys, and I think about doing all sorts of dirty stuff to them, like taking their clothes off and kissing them all over and playing with their things. And there's this one boy, and he's my best friend, and he sleeps in the bed next to mine, and I can't stop thinking about him all the time. And sometimes when he's asleep, I pull my pajamas down and I have a right go at myself, and I create an unholy mess in the bed. And even after I do it and think that I might be able to go to sleep, I start thinking about other lads and all the things I want to do to them. And do you know what a blowjob is, Father? Because I started writing stories about the lads I like, and particularly about my friend Julian, and I started using words like that, and...
There was an almighty crashing sound from opposite me, and I looked up, startled. The shadow of the priest in the darkness had vanished, and in its place a beam of light was streaming in from up above.
"Is that you, God?"
I said, looking up towards its source.
"It's me, Cyril."
From outside the confessional, I heard shouts and opened the door to peep outside. The priest had fallen out of his box and was lying on the floor, clutching his chest. He must have been at least 80 years old, and the parishioners were leaning over him, crying out for help as his face began to turn blue. One of the floor tiles had broken in two next to his head. I looked down at him, my mouth open in bewilderment, and he slowly raised a gnarly finger and pointed at me. His lips parted, and I saw how yellow his teeth were as he began to dribble down his chin.
"Am I forgiven, Father?" I asked, leaning over him, trying to ignore the stench of his breath. "Are my sins forgiven?"
His eyes rolled in his head. His entire body gave one great convulsion. He let out a roar, and that was it. He was gone.
"God bless us. Father's dead,"
said an elderly man who had been kneeling on the floor supporting the priest's head.
"Do you think he forgave me?" I asked. "Before he croaked, I mean."
"He did, I am sure of it,"
said the man, taking my hand now and letting the priest's head fall rather hard against the marble floor, a tinny sound echoing around the church.
"And he'd be happy to know that his last act on this earth was to spread God's forgiveness."
"Thank you,"
I said, feeling cheered by this. I left the church as the ambulance men made their way inside. It was an unusually sunny day, and, truth be told, I did feel absolved, even if I knew that the feelings that I had hidden inside myself wouldn't be going away any time soon. The next morning, I awoke to the news that Julian had been found. A group of special branch officers had followed leads that led them to a farmhouse in Cavan, and he was discovered locked in a bathroom while his three captors slept outside. One was killed in the ensuing fracas, and the other two were under arrest. Missing a toe, a thumb, and an ear, the rest of him was still intact, and he had been taken to hospital to begin his recovery. Had I been a person of more religious scruple, I might have believed that God had answered my prayers. But the fact was, before going to sleep that night, I'd already committed a few more sins. So, instead, I put it down to good detective work on the part of Ungardy Siacona. It seemed like the most convenient explanation to me.
1966. In the Reptile House.
Like soft pillows. Although the strict routine was drearily repetitive at times, I found its familiarity strangely comforting. Every morning my alarm would sound at 6 o'clock precisely, and I would engage in a little light onanism before rising at 4:15. Being first in line to the shared bathroom meant there was no risk of the water turning cold, and when I emerged, bare-chested and with a towel wrapped around my waist, there was Albert Thatcher, the young accountant who had the room next to mine, wearing a pair of wife fronts and a sleepy expression, which was not an entirely disagreeable way to start the day. Albert and I had been lodgers at the home of an elderly widow, Mrs. Hogan, on Chatham Street for more than a year, moving in only weeks apart, and we generally got along quite well. The building itself boasted a rather odd design. One flat had been purchased by Mrs. Hogan's late husband some 30 years earlier as a rental property, and after his death, a dividing wall had been removed to create 2 upstairs bedrooms. Mrs. Hogan and her son Henry, however, lived in the house next door, the former entirely mute, the latter completely blind, and yet between them they monitored our comings and goings with all the efficiency of a government intelligence agency. Like conjoined twins, the two were never seen apart. Henry's arm permanently attached to his mother's as she led him to and from Mass every morning and up and down the street for his evening constitutional. On the rare occasions when they ventured upstairs, looking for overdue rent, perhaps, or returning shirts that Mrs. Hogan ironed at a rate of 2d for 5, we would hear their 4 feet slowly ascending the staircase, the mute leading the blind, and Henry, who seemed to have no interest in anything, would ask the questions that his mother, an inveterate busybody, wanted answered.
"Mammy says there were strange noises coming from upstairs a week last Tuesday,"
he said once in a typical exchange, while Mrs. Hogan nodded furiously, craning her neck to see whether we had marijuana plants growing in the living room or prostitutes asleep in one of our beds.
"Mammy doesn't like strange noises. They unsettle her something awful."
"It can't have been us," I replied. "A week last Tuesday, I went to the pictures to see Steve McQueen in the Sand Pebbles, and Albert was out dancing at the Astor Ballroom in Dundrum."
"Mammy says the noises kept her awake,"
Henry insisted, his eyes rolling in his head as they tried to latch on to something that might restore his view on the world.
"Mammy doesn't like being kept awake. Mammy needs her sleep."
"Were you kept awake yourself, Henry?" asked Albert, from where he was lying on the sofa reading One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and the unfortunate young man jumped in surprise, turning his head in the direction of the voice. Perhaps he'd been unaware that someone else was even in the room.
"When Mammy is awake, I am awake," he replied,
offended now, as if we had accused him of being a bad son.
"She's a martyr to the hemorrhoids. When they're acting up, neither of us can get a wink."
The noises in question were, most likely, not of my making at all, but of Albert's, who was something of a ladies' man, and rarely went a week without bringing a girl home for what he called a bit of slap and tickle, "How's your father? Say no more," which was tortuous for me because his headboard was loosely fitted on the other side of the wall to my own, and this meant that when he was riding a girl, the endless banging would keep me awake, just as Mrs. Hogan's piles prevented her from sleeping.
I had a bit of a crush on Albert, too, which didn't help, but this was more a consequence of our daily proximity than anything else, for he wasn't particularly good-looking. I left the flat every morning at 7:30 to make my way towards the Department of Education on Marlborough Street, stopping only for a cup of tea and a fruit scone along the way, and was usually at my desk on the first floor by 8:15. I had been working there for almost 3 years by now, ever since leaving Belvedere College in a blaze of mediocrity, thanks in part to the good offices of my adoptive father's third and now estranged wife. This was how we determined I should refer to her in conversation, Angela, who had been a popular figure at the department until her marriage to Charles when, as the law dictated, she was forced into retirement. Things had ended badly between the pair less than a year after their wedding when, in an act of uncharacteristic generosity, Charles had invited me to accompany them to the south of France for 2 weeks' holiday. I had met Angela only once in advance of the trip, but from the moment we arrived in Nice, we got along famously. So well, in fact, that I woke one morning to find her climbing into bed next to me, naked as the day she was born. And as I was naked, too, the entire scene turned into something of a West End farce. I cried out in surprise, and, upon hearing the door open, ran headlong to the comfort of the wardrobe, until Charles wrenched the doors open to find me cowering inside. "The funny thing is, Cyril," he said in his most withering tone as I sat curled in the corner, my hands modestly covering my groin, "I'd have a lot more respect for you if I came in here and you were taking her up the Khyber Pass. But no, that's just never going to be you, is it? You just run and hide. A real Avery would never do that." I said nothing, which seemed to disappoint him even more, and he turned his fury on Angela, who was still lying in bed, the sheet fallen to her waist, exposing her breasts. She seemed bored with the whole scenario, and was rotating one finger around her left nipple in an insouciant manner while whistling, "You've Got to Hide Your Love Away," discordantly. An argument ensued, too tedious to recount, and the upshot was that on their return to Dublin they went their separate ways, and an application was made in the London courts for a speedy divorce. Charles had had the foresight to marry in England in anticipation of such an eventuality. His track record with marriage, after all, was not exemplary. In the meantime, however, as I was lazing around and not doing very much with my time, Angela tried to make amends for embarrassing me by putting in a word on my behalf with her former employers. I received a phone call inviting me in for an interview, which came as something of a surprise, as she had neglected to tell me, and without ever thinking for a moment that I would like to be a civil servant, I woke up one morning, and that's exactly what I was. The work itself was incredibly boring, and my colleagues a little irritating, the engines of their days fueled by personal and political gossip. The office I worked in was large with a high ceiling, an old stone fireplace in the centre of one wall, and a portrait of the minister, relieved of two of his chins, hanging above it. A desk was positioned in each of the four corners. Their occupants, facing the centre of the floor, where a single table stood, supposedly for departmental meetings, but in reality rarely used. Our supposed leader was Miss Joyce, who had been working as a civil servant in the department since its foundation 45 years earlier in 1921. She was 63 years old and, like my late adoptive mother Maud, was a compulsive smoker, favouring Chesterfield regulars, red, which she imported from the United States in boxes of 100 at a time, and stored in an elegantly carved wooden box on her desk with an illustration of the King of Siam on the lid. Although our office was not much given to personal memorabilia, she kept two posters pinned to the wall beside her in defence of her addiction. The first showed Rita Hayworth in a pinstriped blazer and white blouse, her voluminous red hair tumbling down around her shoulders, professing that "all my friends know that Chesterfield is my brand," while holding an unlit cigarette in her left hand and staring off into the distance, where Frank Sinatra or Dean Martin were presumably pleasuring themselves in anticipation of erotic adventures to come. The second, slightly peeling at the edges, and with a noticeable lipstick stain on the subject's face, portrayed Ronald Reagan seated behind a desk that was covered in cigarette boxes, a Chesterfield hanging jauntily from the Gipper's mouth.
"I'm sending Chesterfields to all my friends. That's the merriest Christmas any smoker can have. Chesterfield mildness plus no unpleasant aftertaste," it said.
and sure enough, he appeared to be wrapping boxes in festive paper for the likes of Barry Goldwater and Richard Nixon, who, I'm sure, were only thrilled to receive them. Miss Joyce sat in the corner to my right, the section of the room that got the best light, while in the corner to my left sat Miss Ambrosia, an incredibly vacuous and highly unfocused young woman of about 25, who liked to shock me by flirting outrageously and regularly recounting her multitudinous sexual exploits. She generally had at least 5 men on the go, everyone from barmen to dance-hall entrepreneurs, show-jumpers to pretenders to the Russian throne, and had no shame in juggling them like some nymphomaniacal circus act. Every month, without fail, there would be a day where she would be found weeping at her desk, claiming that she had spoiled herself, and that no man would ever want her now. But usually by tea time, she would sit up suddenly, make a rush to the ladies' toilets, and return wearing a relieved expression, informing us that her Auntie Jemima had come to visit for a few days, and she'd never been so happy to see her. This baffled me, and on one occasion I inquired as to where her Auntie Jemima lived, for she seemed to make it her business to be in Dublin every month for a few days. My colleagues burst out laughing, and Miss Joyce remarked that she too had once had an Auntie Jemima, but that she had last visited during the Second World War, and she didn't miss her one little bit. The final member of our group, Mr. Denby Denby, sat directly across from me, and more often than not, when I looked up, I found him watching me with the intensity of a serial killer deciding how best to disembowel his victim. He was a rather flamboyant fellow in his mid-50s who wore colourful waistcoats and matching bow ties and, in speech and manner, conformed to the traditional stereotype of the homosexual, although, of course, he would never have admitted to such an orientation. He wore his hair in a bouffant style, and it was a curious shade of sickly yellow, more a chartreuse than anything else, although his eyebrows were closer to maize. Every so often, with the same regularity as the visits of Miss Ambrosia's Auntie Jemima, he would come into work with his hair brighter than ever, practically luminescent, and we three would stare at it, trying not to laugh, and he would look back defiantly, daring us to say a word. I almost fell off my seat in amazement one afternoon when he mentioned the existence of a Mrs. Denby Denby in Black Rock and a gaggle of little Denby Denbys, 9 of them, 9, whom he and his wife had produced with astonishing regularity from the mid-1930s into the late 1940s. The possibility of him engaging in coitus with a woman took me by surprise, but the fact that he had done it on at least 9 occasions, 9, was almost too much for my mind to take in. It gave me hope for my own future.
"Here he comes,"
said Mr. Denby Denby, sitting erect in his chair as I strolled through the door that fine spring morning, debuting a new jacket I had recently purchased in anticipation of the good weather.
21 years old and never been kissed. Do you know who you remind me of, Mr. Avery? Botticelli's San Sebastian. That's who. Have you ever seen it? You must have. Have you, Miss Joyce? Hangs in the State Museum in Berlin, stripped down to his skivvies and with 6 arrows poking out of his body. Absolutely divine. There's a lesser version by Il Sodoma, but we won't speak of that.
I threw him an irritated look, my first of the day, and sat at my desk, unspooling the copy of the Irish Times that awaited me every morning and turning the pages for anything that might have relevance to our work. From the first day I had arrived in the department, I had resented Mr. Denby Denby's presence, for, although he was even more deeply closeted than I, his willingness to make little secret of his true sexual orientation both embarrassed and confused me.
"Look at those lips, Miss Joyce," he continued,
putting a hand to his heart and fluttering it above his fuchsia waistcoat, as if he was about to pass out in the throes of desire.
"Like soft pillows. The type you, Miss Ambrosia, probably dream of buying in Switzerland if you can save up enough money."
"Why would I need to buy pillows, Mr. Denby Denby?" asked Miss Ambrosia. "Sure as often as not my head's lying on someone else's."
"Oh, get her!"
cried Mr. Denby Denby, and I rolled my eyes. In the office next door, there were 3 quiet gentlemen. Mr. Westlicott Sr., his son, Mr. Westlicott,
and his grandson, Mr. Westlycott, Jr., a family triumvirate who observed the same formality of address as we did, calling each other Mr. Westlycott at all times. And I rather hoped that someone in there would retire or get run over by a bus so I could transfer into their company. And perhaps one or other of them might adopt me, and I could be a Mr. Westlycott too. I was sure to have more success with adoption the second time around than I'd had the first.
"Less tittle-tattle, please, and more work,"
said Miss Joyce, lighting up a Chesterfield red, but no one paid any attention.
"So, tell us, Mr. Avery,"
said Mr. Denby, leaning forward now, his elbows on the table, his head balanced on his hands.
"What mischief did you get up to over the weekend? Where does a handsome young puppy go these days when he's straining at the leash?"
"Actually, I went to a rugby match with my friend Julian," I replied, doing my best to assert my rugged masculinity. "And on Sunday I stayed home and read A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man."
"Oh, I don't read books,"
said Mr. Denby, waving this remark away as if I had expressed an eccentric interest in Middle Eastern symbolism or the origins of trigonometry.
"I'm reading Edna O'Brien," said Miss Ambrosia,
lowering her voice lest any of the Mr. Westlycotts overheard her and reported her for vulgarity.
"She's pure filth."
"Don't let the minister hear you say that,"
said Miss Joyce, blowing a perfect O of smoke from her lips. It was impossible not to stare as it rose towards the light fitting and slowly evaporated into the air before sneaking its way into pollute our lungs.
"You know what he thinks about women who write. He won't have them on the curriculum."
"He doesn't like women who read either,"
said Miss Ambrosia.
"He told me that reading gives women ideas."
"It does," said Miss Joyce, nodding her head fiercely. "I'm in full agreement with the minister on that. My life would have been a lot easier if I'd been allowed to stay illiterate, but Daddy insisted that I learn to read. He was a very modern man, was Daddy."
"I absolutely adore Edna O'Brien," declared Mr. Denby,
throwing his hands in the air in excitement.
"If I wasn't a happily married man, I could get lost in that woman's body for years at a time. I declare before God and all that is good and holy that a more handsome woman was never bred from these shores."
"She left her husband, you know," said Miss Joyce, pulling a face. "What class of a person does something like that?"
"Good enough for him," said Miss Ambrosia. "I'm going to leave a husband one day, too. I've always felt that my second marriage will be much more successful than my first."
"Well, I think it's shocking," said Miss Joyce. "And her with two children to look after."
"Whenever I look at Edna O'Brien,"
continued Mr. Denby,
"I get the impression that she wants to put every man she meets across her knee and give them a good spanking until they show her the proper respect. Oh, to be the bare bottom beneath that alabaster palm!"
Miss Ambrosia spat a little of her tea out, and even Miss Joyce allowed herself something approaching a smile.
"But anyway,"
he said after a moment, shaking his head to dismiss these ideas.
"You were telling us about your weekend, Mr. Avery. Please tell me that it wasn't all rugby and James Joyce."
"I could make something up if you like," I told him, putting down my newspaper and looking across at him.
"Go on, so. I'd love to know what sordid little fantasies come to life in that mind of yours. I bet they'd make a gypsy blush."
He had me there. If I had actually told him any of the fantasies that kept me awake at nights, the two women might have fainted and he might have leaped across the room in lust. I killed a priest after all the last time I recounted the things that I wanted to do, and had no desire to have any more blood on my hands.
"When I was 21,
continued the ridiculous Popinjay, looking toward the fireplace and attempting what can only be called a faraway look,
"I was out on the town every night of the week. There wasn't a girl in Dublin who was safe when I was nearby."
"Really?"
asked Miss Ambrosia, turning to him with an expression that mirrored my own.
"Oh, I know what you're thinking, missy,"
said Mr. Denby.
You look at me now, and you think, how could that slightly plump man, in the autumn of his years, albeit with a magnificent head of blonde hair, ever have been attractive to girls of my age? But I promise you, if you could have seen me in my youth, I was quite the gallant. There was many a girl who threw her cap in the ring for me. Lock up your daughters. That's what the people of Dublin used to say when they saw Desmond Denby Denby coming. But those days are gone now, of course. For every ageing butterfly, there's a young caterpillar. You, Mr. Avery, are that young caterpillar. And you must enjoy your larval period, for it will come to an end all too soon.
What time does the minister have to be in the Dáil today? I asked Miss Joyce, hoping to bring this conversation to an end. And she opened her diary, running a finger down the left-hand side of the page as she tapped the ash from her cigarette into her Princess Grace of Monaco ashtray.
11 o'clock, she said. But I have Miss Ambrosia down to accompany him this morning.
I can't, said Miss Ambrosia, shaking her head.
Why ever not? Asked Miss Joyce.
Auntie Jemima.
Ah,
said Miss Joyce, and Mr. Denby Denby rolled his eyes. I'll do it, I said. It's a sunny day. I'd be happy to get out of the office. She shrugged.
Well, if you're certain, she said. I'd go myself, only I don't actually want to.
Perfect, I said, smiling. The advantage of accompanying the minister to the Dáil was a trip in the ministerial car to Leinster House, where I could leave him alone with his cronies and wait until the minute he entered the chamber for his afternoon nap, when I could be out the door and straight to the pictures, followed by a pint or two with Julian in the palace bar or Kyo's. The perfect day.
I think I should mention,
said Miss Ambrosia, after a rare few minutes of silence when some actual work might have been getting done,
I'm giving serious consideration to having relations with a Jew.
I was taking a sip from my mug of tea when she said this, and nearly spat it across my desk. Miss Joyce raised her eyes to heaven, shook her head, and said,
"Saints preserve us!"
While Mr. Denby Denby simply clapped his hands and said,
"Wonderful news, Miss Ambrosia! There's nothing more delicious than a little Jew boy. What's his name, anyway? Anshul? Daniel? Eli?"
"Pater," said Miss Ambrosia. "Padro Murhu."
"Jesus wept,"
replied Mr. Denby Denby.
"That's about as Jewish as Adolf Hitler."
"Oh, for shame!" cried Miss Joyce, slapping a hand down on her desk. "For shame, Mr. Denby Denby!"
"Well, it's true," he said,
not looking the least bit guilty before turning back to Miss Ambrosia.
"Tell us about him, ducky. What does he do? Where does he live? What does he look like? Who are his people?"
"He's an accountant," said Miss Ambrosia.
"Well, of course he is,"
said Mr. Denby Denby, waving this away.
"I could have guessed that. They're all accountants, or jewellers, or pawnbrokers."
"He lives with his mother off Dorset Street. He's neither tall nor short, but he's a lovely head of curly black hair, and he's a great kisser."
"Sounds divine. I think you should do it, Miss Ambrosia. And I think you should take photographs and bring them in for us all to see. Is he big in the downstairs department, do you think?"
"Cut, of course.
That's not his fault. That's parents mutilating a boy before he even has a say in the matter."
"Ah, now, this is getting beyond the beyonds," said Miss Joyce, raising her voice. "We need to tame the conversation in this office. We really do. If the minister came in and heard us,
he'd see that we were just concerned for Miss Ambrosia and hoping to steer her in the right direction," said Mr. Denby Denby. "What do you think, Mr. Avery? Should Miss Ambrosia have kind relations with her curly-haired Jew? A big cock makes all the difference, don't you think?"
"I really don't care," I said, standing up and making my way to the door so no one could see how red my face had gone. "Now, if you'll excuse me, I'll be back in a moment."
"Where do you think you're going?"
asked Miss Joyce.
"You've only been here 10 minutes.
"Call of nature," I said, disappearing down the corridor and into the gents, which was mercifully empty, and I stepped into a cubicle to pull down my pants and examine myself carefully. The rash had just about cleared up, thankfully. The redness had dissipated, and the itching had gone away at last. The cream the doctor had given me had worked a treat. "You must be wary of dirty girls," he told me, as he buried his face in my crotch, using a pencil to lift my flaccid penis from where it hung in disgrace.
"Dublin is full of dirty girls. Find yourself a nice, clean Catholic wife if you can't control your lust."
I flushed and stepped outside again to wash my hands, and there was Mr. Denby standing by one of the sinks, arms folded, giving me one of those smiles that suggested he could see right through to the depths of my soul, a place even I did not like to visit very often. I glanced at him for a moment, said nothing, and turned on the taps so forcefully that they splashed up on us both.
"Did I see you out and about on Saturday night?"
he asked me without any preamble. "I beg your pardon?" I said.
"Saturday night,"
he repeated.
"I was taking a walk along the banks of the Grand Canal and happened to pass a little establishment that I've heard rumours about over the years. Rumours to the effect that it is a place frequented by gentlemen of a certain perverted disposition."
"I don't know what you mean by that," I said, not looking up at the mirror.
"Mrs. Denby's older sister lives on Baggot Street, you see," he continued, "and I was on my way over to drop off her pension. The poor dear can't get out any more. Arthritis,"
he added, mouthing the word for no discernible reason.
"We'll say nothing."
"Well, I don't know who you think you saw, but it certainly wasn't me. I was out with my friend Julian on Saturday night." "I already told you that."
"No. You said you went to a rugby match with him in the afternoon, but that you spent the evening at home reading. I know next to nothing about sporting events, but I know that they don't take place under cover of dark. It's other things that happen then."
"Yeah, sorry, yes," I said, growing flustered now. "That's what I meant. I was at home reading Finnegan's Wake."
"It was Portrait of the Artist earlier. If you're going to make up a book, Cyril, don't make up one that no one with even an ounce of sense would bother reading. No, this was almost midnight and..."
"You were bringing your sister-in-law's pension over at midnight?" I asked.
"She stays up very late. She's a martyr to the insomnia."
"Well, you must be mixing me up with someone else," I said, trying to get past him. But he swept to the left and right like Fred Astaire as he blocked my path. "What do you want from me, Mr. Denby?" I asked. "Julian and I went to the game in the afternoon, then we went for a few drinks. Afterwards, I went home and spent an hour or two reading." I hesitated and wondered whether I could get the next phrase out. I'd never said it aloud before. "And then, if you must know, I went out for dinner with my girlfriend."
"Your what?"
he asked, raising an eyebrow in amusement.
"Your girlfriend, is it? This is the first we're hearing about that."
"I don't like to bring my private life into work," I replied.
"So what's her name, this girlfriend of yours?"
he asked. "Mary Margaret Moffat," I said.
"Is she a nun?"
"Why would I be dating a nun?" I asked, bewildered.
"I'm joking,"
he said, holding his palms out before me, and the scent of lavender wafted in my face.
"And what does little Miss Moffat do, if you don't mind me asking, when she's not sitting on her tuffet? Or yours?"
"She's an assistant on the foreign exchange desk at the Bank of Ireland, College Green."
"Oh, the glamour! Mrs. Denby worked in the office at Arnott's when I first met her. I thought that was the height of it, but it looks as if you've set your sights on banking over trade. You're like one of those spinsters straight out of Mrs. Gaskell. It won't make it any easier, though, you know."
"It won't make what any easier?" I asked.
"Life,"
he said with a shrug.
"Your life."
"Can't you just let me pass?" I asked, looking him in the eye now.
"I only say it because, believe it or not, I care about your welfare,"
he said, moving to the side now and following me out the door.
"I know it was you that I saw, Cyril. You have a very distinctive gait. And I'm just saying that you need to be very careful, that's all. The Gardaí have a habit of raiding that establishment when they're in the mood for a little mindless persecution, and if you were to get yourself into trouble, well, I don't need to tell you that your position here at the department would be in the most serious jeopardy. And just think what your mother would say."
"I don't have a mother," I told him, slipping out the side door to the carpool, where I saw the minister approaching and raised a hand to greet him. As we drove off, I looked back towards the front door of the building and saw Mr. Denby watching me go with a pitiful expression on his face. From a distance, his hair looked brighter than ever, like a beacon leading a sinking ship to safety. The Great Shrivelling. The circumstances of my reacquaintance with Mary Margaret Moffat were neither romantic nor propitious. A journalist from the Sunday Press by the name of Terwilliger was writing a weekly series on crimes that had shocked Ireland since the foundation of the state, and he wanted to include an article on the kidnapping and mutilation of Julian Woodbead, perhaps the most infamous of all offences in recent years since it had involved a minor. He found contact details for the four main participants in the drama, excluding the two remaining kidnappers themselves, of course, who had been incarcerated in the Joy since 1959. But only Mary Margaret and I were available to talk to him. At the time, Julian was travelling through Europe with his latest girlfriend Susie, a ghastly piece of high-class ornamentation whom he'd picked up while walking along Carnaby Street in search of a Homburg similar to the one that Al Capone had favoured. I had met her only once, when they had come back to Dublin for a weekend to visit Max and Elizabeth. She bit her nails constantly and chewed on pieces of roast beef before spitting the gnarled remains into a see-through bag that she carried with her for just that purpose. She didn't swallow, she told me, as she was far too committed to her modelling career to risk anything entering her stomach. "That's not strictly speaking true," said Julian, with a predictable smirk, and I pretended not to have heard him. Instead, I asked her whether she knew Twiggy, and she rolled her eyes. "Her name," she said, as if I was the most ignorant creature on the face of the planet, "is Leslie." "But do you know her?" "Of course I know her. We've worked together a few times." "What's she like?" "Pleasant enough, I suppose. Too nice to have any lasting career in this industry. Believe me, Cecil, this time next year no one will remember her name."
"It's Cyril," I said.
"And what about the Beatles? Do you know them?"
"John's a friend," she replied with a shrug. "Paul isn't, not any more, and he knows why. George was my last before Julian."
"Your last what?" I asked.
"Her last fuck," said Julian, taking the grisly remains of his girlfriend's dinner and placing it on the table behind us.
"Can you believe it? George Harrison walked in the door just before me." I tried not to throw up.
"No, there was someone else,"
said Susie nonchalantly.
"What?
Who?
I thought I came next."
"No, you couldn't do it, remember?"
"Oh, yes," he said, grinning a little. "I forgot."
"Couldn't do it?" I asked, intrigued.
"Why not?"
"Crabs," he said with a shrug. "Picked them up from God knows who. Susie wouldn't come anywhere near me until I had a clean bill of health."
"Well, of course I wouldn't," she said. "What do you take me for?"
"And what about Ringo?" I asked, wanting to move away from Julian's crabs. "Where do you stand on him?"
"I don't stand anywhere on him," she said,
waving his name away like an insolent fly that was buzzing around her face.
"I'm not sure he's worth standing on. I mean, all he does is play the drums. A trained monkey could do that."
The conversation continued in this way for some time. Susie had strong views on Cilla Black, Mick Jagger, Terence Stamp, Kingsley Amis, and the Archbishop of Canterbury, four of whom were former lovers of hers, and by the end of our night out, I disliked her even more than I disliked the idea of her, which, previous to that evening, had not even seemed possible to me. Naturally, I didn't tell Mr. Terwilliger any of this when he phoned, simply mentioning that Julian was out of the country and uncontactable. He was very disappointed. Julian was the star turn, after all, and said that this was the second piece of bad news he'd received, for Julian's former paramour, Bridget Simpson, wasn't available either. "She's probably forgotten all about him anyway," I said. "I dare say she's been through quite a few Julians since then."
"Actually, no," said the journalist. "Miss Simpson is dead."
"Dead?"
I repeated, sitting up abruptly in my office chair in the same way that Miss Ambrosia did whenever she realized that her Auntie Jemima had come to visit.
"How dead? I mean, how did she die?"
"She was murdered by her driving instructor. Apparently she wouldn't play with his gear stick, so he drove the pair of them into a wall out near Clontarf. She died in impact.
Jesus, I said,
uncertain how to respond to this. I hadn't liked her very much, but that had been years ago.
It seemed like a nasty end.
So that just leaves you and Miss Muffet, he said.
Who? I asked.
Mary Margaret Muffet, he said, and I could tell that he was reading the name from a piece of paper. She was your girlfriend at the time, am I right?
She was not,
I cried, even more shocked by this insinuation than I had been by the news of Bridget's death. I barely knew the girl. She was a friend of Bridget's, that's all. I don't even know how they knew each other. She came along to make up a foursome.
Ah, right, he said.
Well, she's agreed to meet with me. Do you think you'd be able to come along at the same time? It would make more sense if I could get a conversation going between the pair of you, a reminiscence of what happened on the day in question. You know how it is. Otherwise, she'll tell me one thing when I'm talking to her, and you'll say something completely different, and the reader won't know who to believe.
I wasn't sure that I wanted to have any part of it, but didn't like the idea of Mary Margaret, of whom I had only a vague memory, having the spotlight all to herself and making potentially slanderous remarks about Julian to the national press. So I agreed to meet with them. When I arrived on the appointed afternoon, I shook hands with her warily, but, to my relief, our joint recollections of that day in 1959 did not differ very much. We told Terwilliger everything we remembered, although Mary Margaret made it clear that she was unwilling to discuss the surprise involvement of Brendan Behan in the incident for the simple reason that the man was a vulgarian and she wouldn't like his words to be repeated in a newspaper where impressionable children might stumble upon them. Afterwards, it seemed polite to ask whether she wanted to join me for a cup of coffee, and we made our way towards Bewley's Café on Grafton Street, taking one of the booths by the wall as we tried our best to make conversation.
"I generally don't like Bewley's," said Mary Margaret, pulling a handful of napkins from the dispenser on the table and placing them on the seat beneath her bottom to avoid any contamination. She wore her hair in a bun at the back of her head, and, although she was dressed like a representative from the Legion of Mary, there was no denying that she was pretty enough if you liked that sort of thing.
"The seats can be terrible sticky. I don't think the girls clean them after people drop their crumbs. That wouldn't be my standard at all."
"But they do make a good cup of coffee," I said.
"I don't drink coffee," she said, taking a sip from her tea. "Coffee is for Americans and Protestants. Irish people should drink tea. That's how we were brought up, after all. Give me a nice cup of Lyons, and I'm content."
"I don't mind the occasional cup of Barry's myself."
"No, that's from Cork. I only drink Dublin tea. I wouldn't risk something that's made the journey up on the train. They do a lovely cup of tea in Switzer's Café. Have you ever been there, Cyril?"
"No," I admitted. "Why, is that somewhere you go a lot?"
"Every day," she said, beaming with pride. "It's very convenient for those of us employed by the Bank of Ireland on College Green, and it has a more elite clientele, which seems only right and proper. I don't think the bank directors would be at all happy if they saw me in my old street café."
"Right," I said. "Well, you're looking great anyway."
"That was a mad day all the same, wasn't it? The day Julian got kidnapped."
"It was very disturbing,"
she replied, shivering a little, as if someone had just walked over her grave.
"I had nightmares about it for months afterwards, and when they started delivering his body parts..."
"And that was terrible," I agreed.
"How is he, anyway?" she asked me. "Are you still in touch?"
"Oh, yes," I said, quick to assert our ongoing alliance.
"He's still my best friend.
And he's very well, thanks for asking. He's in Europe at the moment, but he sends me the occasional postcard. I'll see him when he gets back. We phone each other sometimes, too. I have his parents' phone number here. Look."
I took out my address book and flicked through to the W's, displaying the Dartmouth Square address that had once been mine.
"He has my number, too, and if he can't get me, he always leaves a message with my flatmate, and he passes it on."
"Settle down, Cyril," she said, frowning a little. "It was just a question."
"Sorry," I replied, feeling a little embarrassed by my enthusiasm.
He got over it, then?
She asked. Got over what?
The kidnapping, of course.
Oh, yes. He's never been the type to let anything like that get him down.
And the loss of a toe, finger and ear?
He still has 9 of each. Well,